Hello, everyone. This is Jim Lindsay. Today, President-elect Joe Biden announced his plan to nominate Ambassador William J. Burns as director of the Central Intelligence Agency. Back in the summer of 2019, I sat down with Ambassador Burns, one of America's most accomplished and respected diplomats, to discuss diplomacy in the age of America first. In light of President-elect Biden's announcement, we thought that our discussion would be an especially timely episode to resurface. It fits perfectly with the theme of our Transition 2021 series on the President's Inbox. We hope you enjoy. Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is diplomacy. With me this week to discuss diplomacy in the age of America first is Ambassador William J. Burns. Ambassador Burns is president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He retired from the U.S. Foreign Service in 2014 after a distinguished 33-year career in the Foreign Service. He retired with the rank of career ambassador. That's the highest rank a Foreign Service officer can attain, and it puts him in an exclusive company. Only about 65 people have been named career ambassador since the title was created back in the mid-1950s. Ambassador Burns' final posting was as Deputy Secretary of State, making him only the second serving career diplomat to ever hold that position. His other posts include serving as Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, the number three job at the State Department, Ambassador to Russia, Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs, and Ambassador to Jordan. He is the author of a terrific new book, The Back Channel, a memoir of American diplomacy and the case for its renewal. Like I said, a distinguished career. Ambassador Burns, Bill, if I may, thank you for joining me here today.
Jim, it's great to be with you.
Like I said, the book is terrific. It's a combination memoir and policy analysis. I want to begin with a bit about the memoir part of the book, and that's maybe probably the most basic question. Why did you become a diplomat?
It's a very good question. I wish I could tell you that when I took the examination for the Foreign Service, I was determined then to spend 3.5 decades as a diplomat. Truth is, I was always interested in public service. My dad was a career Army officer, and you know, I learned to respect a great deal his sense of service. Then when I was 18, I spent 3 or 4 months in Cairo, my first real experience overseas. One of my best friends in high school's father had become the U.S. ambassador to Egypt in the summer of 1974. So that was kind of my introduction to the American diplomatic service. And so I thought this was a career that I'd like to explore, and I've been incredibly fortunate in all the years afterward.
It seems like the way you describe it in the book, almost in a lark, decide to take the written exam for the Foreign Service, and then you pass the oral exam. You end up entering the Foreign Service early in the Reagan administration. Your first posting is in Jordan. Tell us what it's like to be a brand new Foreign Service officer on the ground in a country far away.
Well, I should say first that I peaked on my first day in the Foreign Service. You know, thanks to the wonders of alphabetical seating, I was seated next to Lisa Carty, and also a new diplomat who later became my wife. And as I said,
I should note, the book is dedicated to her, I believe.
It is.
You write here, for Lisa, who has enriched my life beyond measure, made everything possible. Nice sentiment.
Well, and that's the reality as well. So as I said, I peaked very early, but I was fortunate. My first post as a diplomat was in Amman in Jordan. And as I mentioned before, I had already become interested in the Middle East. I had studied Arabic when I was in graduate school at Oxford in England. And so I was fortunate. It was a medium-sized post in a really interesting part of the Middle East. And so it was a great way to get introduced to the profession of diplomacy, but also to a place that mattered in ways that, you know, were out of all proportion and to its relatively small size.
So you begin the book with a story about one of your, I don't know whether it's most illustrious, less illustrious moments in the Foreign Service when you volunteer for a special mission when you're in Amman. Tell us a little bit about it.
I used to always use this story with entering classes of new American diplomats to reassure them that your career didn't need to get off to a rocket-propelled start. I volunteered to drive a truck filled with unclassified communications equipment, from Amman to our diplomatic facility in Baghdad. This was in 1983, in the midst of the Iran-Iraq war. And, you know, as a young diplomat, I thought this would be a great adventure. The administrative officer at the embassy in Jordan had assured me that all the skids were greased at the border. I didn't need to worry about anything. And it turned out the skid kids weren't greased. I got to the border, and an Iraqi security officer who bore a striking resemblance to Saddam Hussein ended up confiscating the truck and all of its contents. I drove under police escort from the little Iraqi border town of Rutba all the way through Anbar province and the towns and cities of Fallujah and Ramadi, that later became famous during America's wars in Iraq in subsequent decades. Ended up, to make a long story short, making it to Baghdad. The truck and its contents were never recovered, and I spent the next 30-some years as a diplomat wondering whether my pay was going to get docked for the cost of that equipment. Fortunately, it never was.
Okay, so you overcame that inauspicious event, went on to a terrific career. You worked under, I think, at least 10 secretaries of state.
Mm-hmm.
And you, in the book, talk a bit about your thoughts on each of them. One person who seems to hold a special place for you is James Baker.
Mm-hmm.
You write that he remains special to you. What was it that was particularly important about Secretary Baker and the way he operated?
Well, I think the truth is it really was about the intersection of a moment in the history of American foreign policy and the international landscape, intersecting with a group of American statesmen, starting with President George H.W. Bush and including Secretary Baker, Brent Scowcroft, then the head of the National Security Council staff, Colin Powell, as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, which was remarkable, I think, in its capacity for understanding both the moment and, you know, how best to apply America's unrivaled influence at that moment to try to create a post-Cold War order internationally that would suit American interests and the values that matter to us and matter to many other people long after that moment of singular American dominance would apply. And so I learned a lot in that period. It was one of those very rare plastic moments on the international landscape that, in my experience, you know, comes along pretty rarely, you know, maybe once or twice a century. It happened in 1945. Again, in 1989 with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War. And Baker and President Bush, as well as Scowcroft, you know, had a clear sense of strategic purpose. They would disagree on issues, which was healthy to have that debate. But at the end of the day, they shared a broad vision, I think, of America's role in the world. They had a sense of strategic empathy, an ability, for example, to understand Mikhail Gorbachev's predicament at that stage. You didn't see them spiking the football on top of the Berlin Wall at the end of the Cold War. And in Baker's case in particular, a real sense of persistence and tactical agility, which, you know, I learned at an early stage in my career as a diplomat is essential to effective American diplomacy.
How so?
Well, part of it was, you know, some of these aren't high points in American diplomacy, in illustrating the virtues of persistence. I remember one very long meeting that Secretary Baker had with Hafez al-Assad, the then bloody dictator of Syria, the father of the current bloody dictator of Syria. This meeting went on for 9 hours.
9 hours?
In 9 hours, one of the longest consecutive diplomatic sessions I was ever a part of.
Any bathroom breaks? Meal breaks?
No, and that was the challenge, because Hafez al-Assad had this really disconcerting habit of sitting motionless in his seat for hours on end, drinking endless cups of sweet Arabic tea and not budging. And Baker, ever the competitive Texan, was okay, determined to match him. About 4 hours into the meeting, our then ambassador in Damascus, a wonderful American diplomat, cracked and whispered to Baker that he had an urgent phone call to make. And he had urgent business, but it wasn't a phone call. And so that enabled...
I wouldn't have lasted an hour.
But that enabled Baker and Assad to spend the next 45 minutes, you know, commiserating about bladder-challenged American diplomats. But it was, you know, it was a small reminder that persistence and stamina sometimes in diplomacy is almost as important as the leverage you bring to the table and, you know, other aspects of negotiating skill.
Over the course of your career, certainly the first half of your career, you held a number of staff positions. Mm-hmm. I think at the age of 32, you became a senior director at the White House, which is a pretty significant feat. I think it was Colin Powell who... Mm-hmm. Posted you to that job. Eventually, you got to be an ambassador first in Jordan mm-hmm. and then in Russia. Tell us a little bit about what it's like to be an ambassador, particularly in those countries where there clearly was at the time, still is today, some really significant issues, both domestically and in U.S. relations.
I always felt over the course of my career, I mean, I was very fortunate, but there's no job that I enjoyed more than being a U.S. ambassador overseas. I mean, in many respects, you're the embodiment of the United States, of the U.S. government, at least, for not just a foreign government, but a foreign society. And so your capacity to navigate that society, to understand understand it, as well as to understand American policy and how best to promote it, is really significant, I think. And good ambassadors, I learned over the years, aren't just serving as postmen. They're not just waiting for instructions from Washington. They're, you know, trying to shape the policies that they carry out as well. So both of those experiences in Jordan, pretty early on in my career, and then later, a decade ago in Moscow as the U.S. ambassador, much different societies, much different relationships, but both fascinating experiences, and in many respects, the highlight of my time as a diplomat.
You note in your book you learned a lot from Ambassador Tom Pickering. Mm-hmm. You describe him as the most capable diplomat for whom you ever worked when you staffed him at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow. Mm-hmm. What sort of made Tom Pickering the giant that he is?
Well, it's a combination of intellect, curiosity. I mean, he was as curious and as adept at understanding, you know, the widgets and the boiler room of embassies as he was, you know, high politics and high policy navigating in those days in the 1990s, Yeltsin-era Russia as well. He was a really fine leader in the sense that he led by example. No one worked harder. No one, as I said before, was more curious. No one was more professional in his approach to, you know, how best to carry out American policy and American diplomacy. And he was always attentive to the needs of his own people as well, which is also, I think, really important for leaders who sometimes are better at managing up and managing over than they are leading and managing down, in a sense. And he was always, I think, very attuned to people who worked for him as well as their families.
So take us to the moment you're ambassador in Russia. You were ambassador mm-hmm. in Russia from 2005 to 2008. Looking back on it, how difficult was it to be ambassador at that time, given the issues that were percolating in U.S. Russian relations? Yeah. It seemed at that point that tensions were growing, and they've certainly grown since then. How challenging was your job?
Well, I mean, navigating Putin's Russia, even in that era a decade ago, is not for the faint of heart. I mean, it's a complicated landscape. Putin himself is a complicated personality. You know, in many respects, a kind of combustible combination of grievance and ambition and insecurity all wrapped together. I vividly remember my first encounter with Putin as the newly arrived U.S. ambassador. We met at the Kremlin, which, as you well know, is built on a scale that's meant to intimidate visitors, especially newly arrived American ambassadors. You walk, you know, through these huge, ornate halls down long corridors. You come to the end of one hall, and there are these two-story bronze doors, and you're kept waiting there for a few minutes just to let all this sink in. Doors open a crack, out comes Vladimir Putin, who, despite his bare-chested persona, is not the most intimidating figure physically that you'll ever run into. But I remember him coming through the door, great self-assurance. Before I got a word out of my mouth, he said, "You Americans need to listen more. You can't have everything your own way anymore. We can have effective relations, but not just on your terms." That, in my experience, was vintage Vladimir Putin. He had a chip on his shoulder. It was not subtle. In many ways, you know, it was kind of defiantly charmless. But his point was that, you know, if Russia in the 90s thought that the West, and in particular the United States, had taken advantage of Russia's moment of historical weakness, his mission, as he saw it, was to push back, to restore the power of the Russian state in Russia, and to restore Russia to what he saw to be its entitlement, its place at the table of great powers.
So what does an ambassador say when the president of the host country says what Mr. Putin said to you? Or do you just listen?
No, I mean, in that instance, I remember laying out for him, you know, what President Bush and Secretary Rice at the time had asked me to do in Russia. It wasn't a long exchange. But I remember other exchanges with Putin a couple years later. I remember summer of 2007, I think, where we had been meeting about another subject, and he took me aside afterwards and, you know, with very pointedly said that basically we understand that American diplomats are running around our country across Russia's 11 time zones, and you're interfering. This was in the run-up to Russia's Duma or parliamentary elections, which were scheduled to take place later that year in 2007. And I explained to him as clearly and plainly as I could that what we were doing was what diplomats from any country do around the world, and that's to try to understand the politics and the political system of another country. We weren't putting our thumbs on the scales. But I remember he was entirely unconvinced of that. And at the end of the conversation, I remember in something that was kind of eerily prescient in a way, said, "Don't think we won't respond to your interference." This was in 2007. And so for Putin, this was all about projection. You know, it was about assuming that, you know, we were determined to undermine him, undermine his political grip, grip and tinker with Russian politics, which was not at all the case in the summer of 2007. But that was the attitude and the mindset that I think brought, you know, if you fast forward almost a decade later to the summer of 2016, his interference in the U.S. presidential elections that year.
I noted, Bill, when we began talking, that your book is entitled The Back Channel, mm-hmm. and it's partly a memoir, but it's also partly a walk through an analysis of American foreign policy over really the last four mm-hmm. decades. You were present at a lot of the major events in American foreign policy. So I'm sort of curious, as you sort of look back over the course of your career and over the course of American foreign policy, what do you think the biggest mistake is that we have made in our foreign policy?
I mean, I think the biggest mistake we made, and I shared in this over the course of my own career, the biggest foreign policy choice that we made was the war in Iraq in 2003. And, you know, I try to write as honestly as I could in the book about the misgivings and the deep concerns that many of my colleagues and I had in the State Department.
Right. You were Assistant Secretary of State for
the
Near East.
For the Middle East, working for Colin Powell as Secretary of State. This is in the first term of the George W. Bush administration. And we were profoundly concerned about the what we saw to be the rush to war in Iraq in that era, based as it was, in our view anyway, on a whole set of false assumptions, not least of which was, you know, how complicated it would be to manage post-Saddam Hussein Iraq as well. I try to be honest in the book, and I try to ground it, actually, in a lot of the documents that I was able to get right. declassified.
I should note that the book comes with a number of those documents, and you quote for them.
Yeah, I do, at the end of the book, and then for those who are really curious, there's about 110 that are online at the Carnegie Endowment now, because I was surprised in a way that I was able to get so much declassified with, you know, relatively few redactions in them. And I did that for a reason. There's always a temptation when you write a memoir to write what you wish you had said or what you wish you had recommended. And I tried to be honest about things I got wrong, and there were plenty of those, as well as some things that I think I got right. The single biggest mistake in terms of foreign policy choices, I think, was Iraq and 2003. You know, there were lots of others. There were lots of things that I think we got right in administrations of both parties.
Things we got right?
Oh, even in that same administration, in the George W. Bush administration, I think the PEPFAR initiative that President Bush, launched, and on which he was able to, you know, persuade the Congress to provide billions of dollars to help Africa, but actually societies around the world, to fight HIV/AIDS, and really to bring the international community to the brink of an AIDS-free generation. That was quite remarkable in many ways, I think. You know, one of the most forward-looking efforts at foreign assistance since the Marshall Plan, you know, after the end of the Second World War. I think, again, looking at the George W. Bush administration, I think the effort to accelerate significantly U.S.-India strategic partnership was another smart long-term investment. And I played an active role in completing the negotiations for the civil nuclear agreement between the United States and India in 2008, which I think was the, you know, one of the defining moments, not just for the Bush administration, but for also for American foreign policy in recent decades. So it's a mix, not just in that administration, but across administrations.
What about NATO expansion? I really want to ask you about that. Sure. Again, given you were ambassador to Russia, you seem to have mixed feelings about NATO expansion.
Well, I think you have to separate, at least in my mind, you know, the first waves of NATO expansion, you know, in the late 1990s, when Poland and several other Central and East European countries became members of NATO. You know, I think we probably all, and here I was sitting as the chief political officer at our embassy in Moscow in the early 1990s, and, you know, we tried to make clear that, you know, you didn't want to underestimate what the eventual Russian reaction to that would be. But I've never argued that it was a mistake to do that, or that in any way that first wave and the second wave, when the Baltic states became members of NATO, dealt any kind of a lethal blow to U.S.-Russian relations. Where I do think we made a mistake was later, towards the end of my tenure as ambassador in the spring of 2008, when we kind of left the issue, at least in my opinion, of NATO expansion on autopilot and, you know, pushed at the end of the George W. Bush administration to open the door, at least formally, to NATO membership for Ukraine and Georgia. And, you know, not just for Putin, for most people, including some of his most progressive critics in Russia at the time, you know, this was the reddest of red lines. In other words, a Ukraine that was formally a member of NATO. None of that justified Putin's aggression in 2014 in Ukraine and the aggressive behavior that he continues to this day. But my concern was it fed Putin's narrative that the United States was out to keep Russia down. I don't think it was a practical possibility anyway in the spring of 2008, because our closest NATO partners, Germany and France in particular, were not going to be persuaded on full NATO membership for Ukraine and Georgia.
Let's look forward for a moment. And if I may, I want to quote a line here from your book. And you write that American diplomacy is adrift at a moment in history in which it means more than ever to our role as the pivotal power in world affairs. What are you worried about?
Well, I mean, I'll start by saying that in 3.5 decades as an American diplomat, I've never seen a moment where American diplomacy mattered more than it does today or been more adrift. It matters more because we're no longer the only big kid on the geopolitical block, you know, with the rise of China, the resurgence of Russia, and the proliferation of a range of other challenges from climate change, the single biggest existential threat out there, through the revolution in technology and the need to begin to develop workable international rules of the road to maximize the benefits and minimize the dislocations. In that moment, even if the United States is no longer the singular dominant player we were early in my career at the end of the Cold War, I would argue we still have a better hand to play than anybody else, any of our major power rivals, not just because of our military and economic leverage, but also because of our capacity to draw on alliances and mobilize coalitions of countries. That's what sets us apart from lonelier powers like China and Russia. Diplomacy ought to be our principal tool for taking advantage of those assets.
You call it a tool of first resort.
Right. At a moment when, you know, our relative weight and influence in the world, while still quite impressive, is less than it was 30 years ago, there are relatively more challenges that require coalitions and partnerships and alliances to tackle, like climate and the revolution in technology. What I worry about, and my concern about drift, is that you're seeing that tool of diplomacy corroded today. And you're seeing those assets, coalitions and alliances, I'm afraid, being squandered. I would add that Donald Trump didn't invent the drift in American diplomacy. I mean, ever since the end of the Cold War, I think we became a little bit complacent, you know, given our unrivaled power. And then after 9/11, there was an almost natural tendency to further emphasize military and intelligence tools at the expense of diplomacy, and a temptation to treat diplomacy across administrations of both parties sometimes as a kind of, under-resourced afterthought. So that's why the argument in the book is that this is a moment, you know, for very practical reasons of American interest and American values, when we need to try to renew diplomacy. And that also, I think, means being honest about the disconnect in our own society between people like me, you know, card-carrying members of the Washington establishment, and lots of American citizens who, in my experience, don't need to be persuaded of the importance of American engagement in the world for reasons of trade and the health of the American economy and our security, but are a lot more skeptical when we preach the virtues of disciplined American leadership, a lot more skeptical about the disciplined part because of instances of overreach and indiscipline as well. So it's going to take a lot of effort in a post-Trump era, whenever that moment comes, I think, to narrow that disconnect and rebuild a sense of trust in disciplined American leadership in the world.
How would you go about making that case to the American public? And I ask because I get to go around the country. Mm-hmm. I do a lot of talks. And one of the questions that comes up invariably is about diplomacy. I note that a fair number of Americans are skeptical of the idea that you can have a foreign service, have diplomats that can work equally well for Republican presidents and Democratic presidents. And so their notion is that somehow these diplomats must be working for one party and against the other party, an idea that I think has gotten a lot more cachet with all this talk about, let me put it in air quotes, the deep state.
Yeah, well, I mean, it won't surprise you. I just think that's a badly mistaken notion. You know, I served, as you mentioned before, Jim, 10 secretaries of state, 5 presidents across administrations of both parties, and I was proud to
serve. You
were
given very high positions by presidents of both parties.
Yeah, I mean, I was the number 3 in the State Department at the end of the George W. Bush administration and was kept on to serve in that role for Hillary Clinton, and then, you know, eventually became the deputy secretary for both Clinton and for John Kerry. as well. So I was proud to serve administrations of both parties. You know, my commitment as a professional diplomat was to the best interests of our country and to serve whatever administration was selected. And I think that is true of my colleagues who are serving today in the State Department. And I just think it's a crock to think of a deep state in the State Department today. You know, if anything, people are almost loyal to a fault. You know, they want to be led. They want their expertise to be taken into account, not always heeded. And it's not like professional diplomats have a monopoly on wisdom, as I've written in my own book. I got a lot of things wrong, too. But I think having that professional cadre of diplomats at this moment on the international landscape is especially important for the United States. It's not fundamentally a question of resources. I mean, the truth is that, you know, I think most Americans sometimes assume that we spend a lot more money on diplomacy and development than we really do. It's less than 1% of the federal budget every year. You know, in the last White House budget proposal a month or two ago, you know, the president proposed $40 billion for all of American diplomacy and all of our assistance programs overseas. Now, that's a lot of money. I understand that. But he also proposed $750 billion, 17 times more, for the U.S. military. Of course, you're going to need a strong U.S. military. You never get very far in diplomacy unless it's backed up by military and economic leverage. But I think we have to be really careful about the imbalance that's beginning to develop. And so I think a carefully funded professional American diplomatic corps that's going to be loyal to whatever administration gets elected is an extremely important tool. And it's far cheaper in terms of the costs in American blood and treasure to at least test whether diplomacy, backed up by economic leverage, by, you know, the resources that the U.S. military brings to bear, it's a lot more effective to at least attempt to see if diplomacy can get you where you want to go, rather than resorting prematurely or too quickly to the use of force.
Yeah, most generals and admirals I've spoken with agree with you. And
right.
General/Secretary Mattis, who said, if you're not going to fund diplomats, be prepared to buy me more ammunition.
Right.
To communicate that idea.
Bob Gates, you know, as another former Secretary of Defense, used to remind people that there are more members of American military bands than there are professional American diplomats. I have nothing against military music. As I said, I grew up as an Army brat, but I think that reflects an imbalance.
So there has been a lot of talk about the State Department losing talent under President Trump. How worried are you about the health of the State Department as an institution, particularly about the Foreign Service, of which you were a member for more than three decades?
Yeah, I do worry about the State Department being hollowed out in this era. As I said before, it's not as if the Trump administration invented the drift in American diplomacy. There have been challenges before. And I would also add that the State Department itself and the career Foreign Service, you know, has some renewing of its own to do. We always talk about the importance of gardening as a metaphor for American diplomacy, you know, our ability to prune and weed on the international landscape in promoting American interests. But we haven't always done a good job with our own patch of turf, our own patch of garden as well. You know, there are individual Foreign Service officers who can be incredibly courageous and resilient and innovative. As an institution, the State Department is rarely accused of being too agile or too full of initiative. So, you know, if we want to make a case for the significance of American diplomacy and the resources that it requires, you've got to demonstrate we can get our own act together, too, which means delayering, making us a more agile institution as well. But having said all those things, you know, I think there is a really important case to be made at this moment on the international landscape, when we're no longer the singular dominant player we were before, to reinvest in diplomacy. And it's going to take a lot longer to fix than it's taken to break, especially over the last 2.5 years, not just with, you know, the number of senior officers who have left, in many cases prematurely, but also because, you know, there's been a significant drop off, as much as 50% in the first couple of years of this administration, in young people and some not so young people applying to join the Foreign Service as well. And so it can be reversed, but we're doing a lot of corrosive damage to ourselves, I'm afraid.
So what advice do you have to that young person, maybe not so young person, who's thinking about trying to join the Foreign Service? given the current context?
Oh, I'm still a huge believer in the Foreign Service. I encourage, you know, I do a lot of university talks today and, you know, connection with promotion of my new book. And I encourage people. For me, there's no substitute for the professional satisfaction as well as the personal satisfaction I got out of public service and service as an American diplomat. You know, all those years back when I had just taken the written exam for the Foreign Service at our old embassy on Grosvenor Square in London, and I had passed, and I was thinking about whether to pursue this to the next step. I remember writing a letter to my dad. This was in the era when you actually wrote letters rather than did emails, and asking him what his advice was. And, you know, he was by then a two-star Army general, and I, as I said before, really respected his commitment to public service. And I remember one line of what he wrote back to me. He said, "Nothing can make you prouder than to serve your country with honor." It didn't register with me at the time, but I spent the next 3.5 decades learning the wisdom of that advice. And so I, despite all the difficulties, and I'm not naive about them, you know, in the State Department, in this administration, for the United States and the world, all the physical risks that diplomats and their families have to run today, you know, serving their country overseas, I still think it's an extremely important profession and a noble one as well. So I encourage young people to apply for the Foreign Service and to join it. I think there's going to be an opportunity to renew the State Department and the Foreign Service, and I think it could be an incredibly valuable moment to be a part of that.
On that uplifting note, I'm going to close the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Ambassador William J. Burns. He is the author of the new book, The Back Channel, a memoir of American diplomacy and the case for its renewal. As I think you've gathered from our conversation, he is truly one of America's greatest diplomats. Bill, thank you for your service. Thank you for joining me on the show.
Tim, thank you so much.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Opinions expressed on the President's Inbox are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlick. Dan Mudd was our recording engineer. Special thanks to Corey Cooper for his assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.